Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Bill Patton, and this show is going to be completely different. Infinite Tennis sometimes just goes slam bang, doesn't do an introduction, and just brings the guests on and we start talking. So today's guest is Matt Cronin, who is a tennis journalist who covers tennis worldwide, both tours, and does a great job, keen observer of the game. Hello, Matt. Are you there?
I am here, Bill. Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you on the show again. Matt and I go back a while, but we're not going to rehash all that stuff. So, Matt, let's dive right in because, you know, what we want to do on this show is talk about kind of one of the current trends of what's happening this year and what do you see coming in the near future. So how would you recap the year of tennis? And as we're looking forward to, you know, the year-end tournaments and all that?
Well, I think, you know, both sides have different storylines, obviously. I think clearly on the guys' side, after Nadal beat Djokovic for the U.S. Open title, having beaten him at Roland Garros also in the semifinals, that he pretty much took over the year. You know, he only had a couple losses since his return from knee problems. At the beginning of February, he's taken over the number one ranking. Something extraordinary would have to happen now points-wise for him to be able to lose that. So he's your player of the year. I think Djokovic did a nice job the last couple of weeks winning two tournaments in Asia and actually getting revenge, slight revenge on Nadal by beating him there in Shanghai. But realistically, you know, Rafa, who a lot of people thought may not be able to come back anywhere close to his former dominant form, really improved a lot this year. I think Djokovic dipped a bit, so now it's pretty much on Novak to improve to the point where he can start beating Rafa in big tournaments again. And at the year-end championships, that's going to be a very good opportunity for Novak indoors on fast surfaces. In fact, for all the guys to get on top of Nadal. And if Djokovic manages to win that tournament, then he can go into the Australian Open with confidence that he can win the title again. And for Rafa, to me, really it's about kind of surviving to the end of the year without getting hurt. He's been playing a lot. He's been complaining about hard courts being too hard on the player's body, but he's had an excellent hard court record this year. And then, you know, flipping to some other guys, I mean, we have Andy Murray now out for the rest of the year, underwent back surgery. Is he going to be able to recover in time to be, you know, pretty competitive next season? Because back surgery for tennis players is rough. And then I would say the final big story on the guy's side would be Roger Federer, worst year of his career since, I'd argue, 2001. He's won one title. He hasn't been that competitive at the slams, really struggling, just split with his coach Paul Anacone, been fiddling with his new rackets. He loves the indoor season. He's won ATP Championship six times. He's won Basel a bunch, which he'll play next week. And for Federer, really, next month or so important for him. He doesn't have to win events, Bill, but just play respectively well, be competitive in those matches. No straight set losses to guys like Tommy Robredo, who he was 10-0 against and lost in straight sets to the U.S. Open. So if he's going to be competitive next year, and I think he will be, he needs the confidence boost.
So let's talk about that coaching, because that's something people want to know about. Do you have any guesses as to who might be some strong candidates to be his coach?
Well, the thing is with Federer is that he's had Severin Luthi, who's the Swiss Davis Cup captain, at his side now for 5 or 6 years. So in a sense, Anacone was coaching him anyways. I think Federer may choose to bring somebody in, but I think he's going to be really careful about doing it. And I would also say on the flip side that even for the top coaches, they've got to be careful there too. Because realistically, at best, Federer wins one more slam. He's going to be 33 next year. He basically can't play with Nadal anymore on any surface. He's struggling against Djokovic on hard courts, against, you know, he's struggling against Murray on certain surfaces. The younger guys, you would think, are going to make some kind of an impression next year and push him. So if I'm a, you know, if I'm a coach, it would have to be a veteran coach who thinks they can maybe tweak a couple things with them, which is what Anacone did, and Roger was going to be able to execute it. So in a sense, Bill, I mean, he just might keep Luthi and call his own shots because he's largely been doing that for years anyways.
Yeah. Now, what about the women's side?
Well, the women's side, you know, a bunch of different storylines this year that sort of culminated in Serena Williams winning the U.S. Open, getting over on who would be her only real rival at this point, Victoria Azarenka, you know, managing to play a great third set there while Azarenka kind of faded. She's been the player of the year. She's the same thing, you know, since Australia, since she hurt her ankle and took that shocking loss to Sloane Stephens. She's been pretty good all around. She loses to Azarenka a couple weeks before the U.S. Open in the Cincinnati final, tight match, but then manages to play well enough, plays mentally strong, keeps calm. Her coach, Patrick Mouratoglou, has done good work with her. She also won Beijing, the one Asian tournament she managed to play. She goes into Istanbul as a serious favorite because not only is she playing at a high level, but for the most part, Bill, you look at her play, and she's so calm on court most times, taking deep breaths, taking her time, and then hitting lethal shots. She's a really good match manager. She's a much better strategic player, I think, that people give her credit for. She almost never calls her she never calls her coach on the court. It's all Serena out there calling her own shots. And in some senses, the last couple of years, she's taken a step up in her career, and now, you know, she's pushing top five of all time. She's got 17 slams right behind Navratilova and Everett. You got to think she's going to tie them next year, and then, I don't know, does she make a run at Graf at 22? Maybe if she stays healthier for a couple of years. But last story on the women's side is outside of Azarenka, no one else is really competing that well for big titles in that younger generation with, you know, Kvitova and Wozniak and Radwanska. I'm not saying they're not struggling to stay relevant, but they're struggling to stay relevant to Serena. So we go in the WTA Championships. I really want to see Azarenka and Kvitova. At least Radwanska I don't think can do it at this point, but those two try to push Serena a little bit, get in her head.
Well, for me, I root for one female player and one only, and that's Jamie Hampton because she comes to the net.
Kvitova comes to the net some, too. Yeah, I like Jamie Hampton's game, too.
So,
I do.
All right,
but, Bill, I mean, she's not – she's had a year-end injury, and she's had some good results this year, but – you know, the match against Sloane Stephens at U.S. Open and even in Wimbledon, I mean, she even admitted after that, Sloane's a better big match player than she is. And Jamie's got game, but mentally she's not as good as some of the younger players are, at least yet.
And I wish I could be a Sloane Stephens fan. I think she's interesting, but her game is built to be incredibly streaky because of the way her timing is so interesting. And when it's all on and everything's going, she can whack the crap out of the ball. And if somebody's really hitting her consistent pace, but anybody who do jacks her around, you know, she falls apart. So
yeah, she can. I mean, she's sort of a tweener. She's a very interesting player to me because she came up as a very fast, good counter puncher. Then she developed a lot of force on her forehand side, a little more on the backhand. First serve isn't bad, and she's sort of in the place where she can't decide sometimes whether she should just be playing sturdy defense or going on offense. But I do, really. She's had, emotionally, with the controversy she had with Serena in the spring, she's had some tough issues this year. But game-wise and attitude-wise, if she can pull it together, she's definitely a top-five player to me, without question.
Yeah. Now, you know, I've heard it said that people are looking back at, like, a Nadal going away from the game for months and then coming back stronger and better, which is kind of, you know, interesting. And I've had one guy say that he sees a trend where players are going away for a certain period of time with a major injury, and then they step on the court, and within a matter of weeks, they're playing better than ever before. And his opinion is that that's a sign that there's some untoward behavior, maybe with performance-enhancing drugs. So What can you tell us about, you know, what you're seeing with that? How seriously are the tours taking that?
I think the tours, or the, you know, the ITF, which pretty much runs the program through WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, take it very seriously. Now, with that said, the guys, because the ITF was somewhat underfunded by the tours, they weren't able to do as much blood testing out of competition as they should have been. But then earlier this spring, the tours voted and the Grand Slams to give them more money, so now the guys and the women are being tested more frequently. With that said, I know there's a lot of suspicion out there, Bill. I mean, I hear it all the time. It's not with just with Rafa. It's also with Djokovic. You know, people say, how can these guys play 2 5-hour matches back-to-back and survive? And, you know, my answer to that is that if they're not testing positively and they do work out as much as they do, and you also have to consider that we both know that tennis is exhausting, but it's not like soccer where you have to constantly run up and down, or like basketball. I mean, there are pauses in between points, right? So I do think there's better fitness. With that said, I know, of course, the tours have at least slight doping problems. We have Marin Cilic and Viktor Troicki, both were top 20 players who are now, you know, out serving suspensions. You know, and Cilic says that, you know, he sent his mom to a drugstore in France and they got him the wrong stuff, so he's out. And Troicki said he refused a blood test and that the doctor told him he couldn't take an extra day, which, in my opinion, is total BS because the doctor's never going to do that. But what we do know, and this is not just tennis, and it's been written and it's been said, for the most part, people who are supplying and creating these drugs are usually ahead of the testers. So I'm not going to name names at all. I mean, to me, I'm hoping every single guy and woman on that tour is healthy, because you don't want to become like cycling, where the sport, to me, has been totally ruined by the fact that every single year the main story coming up to Tour de France is who's doping and who's not. That, you know, you just definitely don't want that to happen. But I do think there are things that are out there that are more available, you know, that can maybe fly under the radar a bit. But in Nadal's case specifically, we should go back to this, because he talked about this recently. He bought some type of machine that dealt with his knees that apparently was banned at one point, I think, by the Olympics. Somehow it's like a compression machine with the knees, but then was unbanned because they thought it was fine, it was legal. That's what he used in his 7 months off. So maybe that actually did hurt him. And he did say, and he says consistently, that his knee hurts him. He's just able to manage the pain. And I don't know about you, but I don't think he came back a much better player. I think he came back possibly slightly improved in some ways, but it's not like, Bill, that he's developed a whole new repertoire. I mean, his inside-out forehand's a lot better, I think, than it used to be. His backhand down the line slightly better. He does move further inside the court when he's confident. When he's not confident, he doesn't. But I don't see an extraordinary change. I mean, you go back to 2011 when Djokovic was beating him. Yeah, Novak was a better player, but by what, 5%? So you could flip that either way, right? Rafa's better than 5% by now. But anyways, interesting discussion.
Well, I think you can also make the point that, I mean, to me, Rafa looks maybe 5 or 10 pounds lighter, so he might have dropped a little weight to take a little pressure off the knees as well. So,
right.
And certainly the science of training athletes, especially tennis players, has become much more specific. So, all right, so let's move to kind of the trends in the business of tennis. You know, we were talking a little bit about tournaments and what's going on with the ownership of those and what's gonna save American. Tell us what you got on that.
Well, New Haven, actually today the vote is coming down, but the state of Connecticut put in a bid to buy the New Haven WTA tournament, which is played the week before the U.S. Open, from the USTA. The USTA tried to sell it to the tournament Winston-Salem, which is an ATP event, which is also played the week before the Open. And the ATP players turned it down because they don't want to have any more combined events with the women, among other reasons, but that's primarily the reason. So New Haven got a chance to save itself because the USTA wanted to sell it. They've got a huge investment coming up in the U.S. Open now with the roof and all the expansions, and they don't want to be carrying money losing tournaments. So they sold it to New Haven at a serious discount, to the state of Connecticut, $618,000, which on the open market, that tournament could have went for $4 million easily. So the vote's coming down on today in Connecticut. I would suspect it's going to pass because it's their development authority that pretty much passes everything. So this is what we're looking at, Bill. The first time, I believe, in tennis history that a state government in the U.S. has bought a tournament to subsidize it for tourist reasons or for Connecticut reasons or whatever else. And we're getting to the point now where you look at almost every single tournament in the U.S. and a lot around the world where almost all the biggest tournaments, if they are not Grand Slams, are either backed by a gigantic agency or by governments. So the little guy that we were talking about this off the air, but the, you know, the Barry McKays and the Jack Cramers or the individual tournament promoters, you don't see much of them around anymore. It's basically just too expensive to go out there and put the money. The Carlsbad WTA sanction, the San Diego sanction, which left for Tokyo, that was being shot for $4 to $5 million in the U.S. and not one single person or company came up and bid for that. No one. And that's a big tournament on the women's side. So, I mean, that I see now is the transition that there's no longer going to be any more fun mom-and-pop operations. And really, it's going to be governments or big corporations, and government seems to be winning.
So I had thought I heard a rumor, and I don't want to start one, but maybe we can avert the rumor. But I thought I heard something in relation to the Bank of the West tournament. That's still going to be at Stanford and for the near term?
Yeah, because they have – it's owned by IMG, which is a big company, and they have, I believe, two more years left with their contract with Bank of the West, which is a bank, title sponsorship. And Bank of the West is owned by BNP Paribas, which is the biggest tennis sponsor in the world. You know, they sponsor all of Davis Cup. They sponsor Fed Cup. They sponsor Indian Wells. They sponsor the French Open. So they're very, very invested in the sport. Now, Stanford needs to do a bit better attendance-wise, and one of the things that's coming out of San Diego now leaving and being off the calendar next year, Stanford actually moves into a worse week because they move in right before two mandatory tournaments in Canada and Cincinnati. So you can expect next year that their player field is actually going to be worse than it is. But I do think in the next couple of years that it stays in there. But, I mean, Bill, look at California where both of us live. San Jose men gone, right? L.A. men gone. L.A. women gone. San Diego women gone. And WTA championships that was played in downtown L.A. up in 2005 is gone. So five events since 2005 are gone, and the only two events now are left are Stanford and Indian Wells. And for a state as big and powerful, and what's the GDP, I believe, of California, what is the fifth biggest in the world? Not just the country, but the world.
Yeah.
But somehow, you know, we can't find a way to get enough people or enough investment in these tournaments.
So it's just a matter of people showing up and voting with their feet. Is that the number one factor behind retaining your tournament, is to show up?
Yeah, I think also with business, too, it's a matter of businesses actually, you know, voting with their pocketbooks. But I do think, and in fact, John Yandel, who I'm sure you know well, who runs a very good website, Tennis Player, which is a lot of instructional. I'm going to be doing this piece for him tomorrow. I mean, if you look at attendance now in sporting events, at least in the United States, overall, and this includes the NFL and Major League Baseball, which are much bigger sports, has been declining now over the last 5 years, and in tennis. And I think the reason for that is because HDTV or digital TV has become so good, and it's so much nicer to watch, Bill, right, than it was 10 or 15 years ago, that a lot of people are figuring, I can watch this on the Internet now, right, so I don't necessarily have to go to the event, or I can watch it at home, and it looks real to life. Why am I going to go out there and spend whatever it is, $50, $100, make the drive, go through traffic, whatever else? I actually think worldwide, except for at the Slams and some of the big tournaments, that attendance is problematic.
Well, when television was invented, didn't they sell the news by saying, you are there?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, because you can see it. Yeah, no, I think that was part of the attraction there. So I'm going to do a commercial here, and then I'm actually at a loss. So you think of what you want to talk about, and then we'll talk about that, whatever that is, right after this commercial. Wow, I'm such a pro radio stuff. It's crazy. So,
Here we go.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Okay, great. So welcome back. And then, so Matt, what's next on the agenda here?
What's next on the agenda? Well, you know what we can talk about, since actually we can maybe finish that discussion too about attendance, because I think one of the things that is great now about the Internet, and I don't know if you get tennistb.com, but I do, and that's a place where you can generally, although it's the worst in the United States, watch a lot of early round matches. So I think so in the so-called back in the day, if you wanted to see tennis matches outside of the slams or occasional, I don't know, bigger Indianapolis-Cincinnati tournaments like that, Miami, you pretty much had to go out there. Now, with these so many more cameras on courts, it's great that you can sit in front of your computer and watch matches, but again, that does not give fans the incentive to go out and actually watch tennis live. And if you are a tennis fan, if you're a parent, and you want your kids to get hooked on the sport, it is so much better, Bill, and you know this, go out and watch some pro tennis live. I don't care what it is, even if it's a Future and Challenger, because up close, as good as HDTV is, it's really the excitement level, the intensity, how hard the ball is hit, the revolutions of spin, the players' real reactions. It's much, much better. And I definitely think, and I don't know what you think, but to me, that's how you get kids hooked on the sport.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like Christmas. Whenever I'm taking kids to go see tennis, you know, they're very, you know, reticent, and they're like, ah, do I have to? And then they get there, and their jaws drop. So, you know, it's, without a doubt, I would say that if there's a night and day with kids in their motivation for how good do they want to be after they've seen it live, without a doubt.
I totally, totally agree with you.
Really,
so another thing we can talk about, and since I'm going to be traveling for 3.5 weeks here to Istanbul and Italy for the Sardinia for the Fed Cup final between Italy and Russia, and then up to London, is how does an international sport like tennis succeed, let's say in the United States, since we're based here right now, because I think that's become a big challenge for tournaments and tennis overall in the U.S., that if you don't have top players, which on the women's side we do and the guys you don't, How do you attract people to the sport? And on the flip side, if you're the International Tennis Federation and you're running competitions like Davis Cup, which is between, you know, Serbia and Czech Republic with big-time players like Djokovic and Burdick and all that, and then Italy versus Russia, how do you make that, and for Fed Cup, how do you make that appear to an international audience? And that, to me, is there's no easy answer to that whatsoever, none whatsoever. And I don't know if you agree with this, at least what I've seen in the United States – on the guy's side the last, say, 5 years or so, is that Federer and Nadal, and then to a lesser degree Djokovic and Murray, are so much more popular than any U.S. male player right now. And if you're a small tournament and you cannot possibly recruit those players because Federer and Nadal are $1 million each minimum now to get them just to appear at a tournament, how do you attract fans? Because the fans out there know, the serious tennis fans know, at least at this point, that Sam Querrey and John Isner are not competing for Grand Slam titles. And they want to see Roger and Rafa. And if they can, are they actually going to see what is, to a degree, a secondary product?
Well, you know, I think I differ with you on that, because I think the casual American tennis fan wants to see an American, and they don't really care about anybody else. But the really
But the really true hardcore tennis fan that loves the sport, I mean, I don't know how many kids are playing with Babolat rackets just because Rafa uses Babolat, and how many kids
sure.
are using a Wilson because Federer uses Wilson. But it's a lot.
Right.
I think kids like whoever the very best person is if they've been exposed to it. So,
yeah.
And, you know, interestingly enough, I saw probably more people wanting to emulate Rafa than I did seeing them wanting to emulate Roddick. So
absolutely. No, we're arguing essentially the same thing. The casual fans may want to see American players, but most serious tennis fans or whatever, junior players, are fans potentially of international stars. Most of it's Federer and Nadal, and I've seen this at Indian Wells, Miami, Cincinnati, the three biggest combined. Those places are, when those guys play, totally packed. People will line up forever to go see those guys play, and those are Americans, most of them. And they're not necessarily lining up to seeing some of the lesser American males play. Those guys are popular, but because those guys don't play tournaments, Bill, like they don't play Delray Beach, they don't play San Jose, they don't play L.A., any of that, will the serious tennis fans come in and watch someone who's ranked, say, number 12, or are they basically saying to themselves, darn it, mom or dad, how come Federer's not playing? How come I can't see Rafa?
Well, and then that, I think the great thing that we still do have is we've got Indian Wells, so better get down there. I mean, I made my first trip there a couple of years ago, and it was just incredible. So, you know, I'll be doing my best to get there and encourage people to go really see the best players there. So anyway, yeah, we're getting close to needing to wrap up. So how about a quick prediction on what's going to happen at the ending championships, and then who do you think is going to emerge at the Australian Open?
Well, I mean, you have to make in Istanbul next week, you have to make the Serena the favorite. I'm not entirely pleased with what I saw at Azarenka since the U.S. Open. Kvitova is a very good indoor player, so maybe she challenges her. I think that Djokovic does win ATP World Finals, although I think, you know, it's the only so-called major title that Nadal has yet to win, and he's won every, you know, all the slams, all the Master Series except for Shanghai. He's won the Olympic gold. He's won Davis Cup, so I think he'll seriously challenge for it. And going into next year, here are my questions, and this is both on the same side. At this point, it appears to me that the top veteran players are still going to be the better players next year. That's on both the men's and women's side. What I really want to see is a guy like Milos Raonic, who's a Canadian, who's ranked number 11, or Grigor Dimitrov, the Bulgarian. I want to see if one of these guys can actually go and make a serious push, meaning not just inside the top 10, but actually reach a slam final or possibly win a slam final. And it's the same thing with the younger girls. There's a ton of, you know, Stevens is out there and Robson and Bouchard and Madison Keys. Can any of them actually start threatening the top five? Because it's been, especially on the guys' side, it's been forever since we've had one breakthrough player basically in the last, 6 years now, which is Del Potro, 2009 U.S. Open. Other than that, the so-called Big Four has ruled everything, and that has never happened in tennis history before.
That's amazing. All right, so that's a great thought to end on, and I really appreciate your time here. So, you know, good luck with all your preparations to go cover tennis around the world.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, thank you, Matt.
Bye-bye.
All right, so that was Matt Cronin, and you know, that's some keen insight right there. I always learn something new from Matt because he's right there with his finger on the pulse of what's going on the tours. I think it's very interesting. Those of you who are tennis stakeholders and you might be dreaming about hosting your own tennis tournament, but it looks like you're probably going to have to get your state or your city or somebody very important on your side there to get that going. It would be terrific to have a regrowing of the tournament schedule back in the States here. Meanwhile, Matt's point is great. There are still many challengers and satellite events to go see, so take your kids to get out there and go see those tournaments up close and see some up-and-coming players. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody, and I appreciate all the listening that you've done to other shows. This one's a little bit different. Next show is going to be with Collins Agwanda from nearby Kisumu, Kenya. So it's can't wait for that one. Have a great day, everybody, and as is my custom, actually, I'm going to leave you with something different today. We're going to do this. Right there.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.